Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today I'm proud to bring you our Sword and Sandal Cinema Special, starring the scholars from the edge of time, Nicholas Dyack and Michelle Brittany. Greetings and welcome, Nicholas and Michelle. How are you?
Greetings, Hercules. Doing very well. And yourself?
I'm also doing very well. I'm looking forward to hearing all about Miss Alina tonight.
We are excited to talk about it, actually. Have you seen the film?
I saw the film very many moons ago. I watched some clips on YouTube to prepare for tonight, and then I started watching the movie, but alas, only got to see like a third of it, so we'll be watching the rest of it.
Well, thankfully, it's not a, you know, an epic in the Ben-Hur vein that's 20 hours long with three intermissions. It's actually a pretty short film.
Yeah, I enjoyed what I watched.
So before we kind of get started, a little bit of context. I'd never seen Messalina before, neither had Michelle. Just a new Blu-ray of the film came out from Twilight Time films or media, whatever they're called. And, of course, I tried to pick up new peplum as it comes out. So it was just kind of an impulse purchase of, hey, you know, here's an old school peplum that's not an alpha video transfer. So let's pick this and add it to the queue of things to watch. So that's kind of our background on the film. This has been kind of sitting there for about a month waiting to be watched. And this seemed like a perfect, what was it? Oh, Twilight Time. I was right. So it seemed like a good opportunity to watch it, to talk about it for this podcast, something that, you know, Michelle and I, you know, both can elaborate on. So we figured Michelle will start with a plot synopsis, and I'll do a little bit of context, and we'll just go kind of back and forth with our general musings and observations about the film.
Sounds like an awesome plan. I'm all ears.
Okay, so to give a little bit of context with regards to Messalina, it was released in 1960. It is an Italian production. It's actually the fourth Messalina film. The original or very first one was during the Silent Era, 1924, also an Italian film. In 1930, Brazil made their own version. And then back to Italy, there was a 1950 film of Messalina, and then, of course, this fourth one in 1960. It was directed by Vittorio Cadafavi. He is also the director of Hercules and the Conquest of Atlantis that was released in 1961. In all, he directed about 70 films spanning from the early 1940s up to about the mid-1980s. I think he died a few years after that. This film stars Belinda Lee. She was a British actress who was starting to make a name for herself. She had started starring actually in supporting roles in kind of the early 1950s. She worked with Ealing Studios for a few films, Hammer Productions, and then she also signed, then she did sign a contract with a Rank organization. And what's kind of interesting is she wasn't yet 21. So her husband actually had to sign her contract for because she wasn't old enough to sign the contract. Messalina was in 1960. She did actually pass away tragically in early 1961. She was in an auto accident in California on her way back from Las Vegas to Los Angeles. The car spun out of control when it blew a tire, and she died from that. So her career was cut very short. Like I said, she was 25 years old. So Messalina. Messalina opens in the gardens at the Temple of Vesta in Rome. A striking young woman draped in white is like a bright beacon in the night as she secretly meets a high-ranking Roman noble by the name of Sapidius. They discuss that the 40-something-year-old Claudius has been chosen by the Senate and the Praetorian Guards to replace Emperor Caligula, which means that the woman, the noble Valeria Messalina, is in line to become the emperor's new wife, even though in a few days she is due to become the Vestal Virgin priestess. Meanwhile, in the evening, a feast is taking place elsewhere nearby. Men are wrestling, and a dance troupe provide us, the audience, an opportunity to meet the rest of the cast. That includes Claudius and the film's hero, Lucius Maximus. Later in the evening, Lucius takes a walk and ends up meeting Valeria. It is love at first sight for Lucius. She actually is kind of coy with him and tells him to come back later and meet her somewhere else in the gardens. On the cusp of her induction to the Temple of Vesta, let's just say if she was a virgin before meeting up with Lucius, she most definitely isn't after a morning romp in the garden. Each are on a separate trajectory. Lucius is...
Total. Very simple.
Lucius is soon to leave to go fight an Armenian war and is sad to leave his lover. And we find in a separate conversation between the primary Vesta priestess, Valeria reveals that her ambition is twofold. Life, and I would say more... succinctly, power and love, both which she says she will find in the world of men. So instead of becoming part of the Temple of Vesta, because let's be honest, she's not a virgin anymore, she goes on to marry Claudius and becomes the empress and consequently the most powerful woman. So while Lucius is off fighting, Valeria is now more famously known as Messalina. She seems to be both loved and hated in extreme by the populace. In the palace, she is conniving for more and more power. She poisons Sulpidius, seduces a would-be assassin, and then has him killed in the morning. She presents his severed head to the aristocrats, and she is not shy about using her sexual prowess to have others killed or manipulated to her conniving ways. When Lucius returns, it is either 2 or 4 years have passed. The film narrative says 2, but throughout the dialogue, they say 4. So we're going to say it's 4 years. He is reunited with Valeria and then eventually learns that she is the Messalina he has been hearing so much about. He only knew her as Valeria, so he didn't know who Messalina was. And so it was a little bit of a surprise to him to find out that his lover is actually the wife of Claudius and is Messalina. The disparity between the common folk, the aristocrats, the senators, basically also the social classes in between, is creating tension and spiraling out of control. Lucius is made Messalina's consul. But when he learns that she was the catalyst for his friend's death, he eventually rallies his legion of troops, of men, and protects Claudius from her plot to kill him. An erroneous report is given to Messalina in the final minutes of the movie and to her latest sexual conquest, who is looking, of course, to become the next emperor. During their celebratory feast, their festivities become an orgy of violence and death. Narcissus, who is a close associate of Claudius, stabs her and she dies, confessing to Lucius that she always only loved him. And that is what.
Wow.
If you haven't seen it in a while, sorry we blew it for you.
It's okay. I don't mind spoilers.
So... let's talk about this film as it came out. So movie came out, as Michelle said, in the 1960s. And, you know, at this time, Italy was in its full economic, you know, post-war boom. And the Italian movie production system was cranking out a lot of films, not just high art films, but also a lot of genre cinema. It cranked out, you know, so much it actually surpassed, you know, foreign imports, you know, more than American films coming in. And this is also the time of, you know, this is the era of peplum, Eurospy, spaghetti western, giallo, gothic horror, spaghetti combat, you know, all these kind of, you know, fun cycles of genre cinema. And it lasted roughly, the high light is from 1958 to 1968, if you go by Peter Bondanella. It was also the era that the Christian Democrats are the political dominating force in Italy, and we'll talk about that in much greater detail, but just know at a high level, they have influence over what can and can't be shown in films. That's kind of where Messalina is being born from, is it's a peplum. I mean, it looks a lot bigger budgeted than a normal peplum, you know, kind of like the Cleopatra Ben-Hur variety. But it's still at heart a sword and sandal. But it's coming out of that fold of, you know, post Hercules, post Ben-Hur, post all that. So it's, that's where it kind of came from. So, if y'all recall, maybe about, I don't know, 2 months ago, we talked about Caesar and Cleopatra, mm-hmm. and I had mentioned that I kind of labeled Caesar and Cleopatra as a very specific type of peplum film, a toga and sandal film. And I want to kind of put out there that Messalina, I think, is a toga and sandal film as well. To me, a toga and sandal film is less on the depictions of strong men. You know, there's really a lack of like Hercules type characters, lack of kind of gladiator type characters. Not saying that they're completely absent, but that's not their focus. It's also a lot less focus on military action. And again, there's certainly military action in Messalina, but it's not the main point. You know, to me, toga and sandal films, they underscore the political intrigue of Rome and other city-states during, you know, Grecian Roman times. You know, these are mostly politicians, are noble people conniving against each other. They're aristocrats. And so the focus is on dialogue and banter between them, seductions, poisonings, secret assassinations. And to me, that's kind of a toga and sandal film. It replaces the sword aspect of it with the toga aspect, which, again, less martial, more dialogue-driven, more character-driven, and more intrigue, I would say. And so just like kind of Caesar and Cleopatra, where, you know, that film didn't even have any fight scenes, really. You know, they all happen off the camera. You know, mm-hmm. this film only has one really big fight scene at the end, where the Praetorian Guards are fighting Lucius and his dispatchment. And there's also a very quick scene in the beginning where two strong men are fighting each other for, like, kind of, you know, amusement for Claudius. But it's, you know, it's not like an arena of sorts. It's more for show. You know, they're just kind of slapping each other. And, of course, you know, Lucius goes in there and says, I can take both of them at the same time, and he easily does. And I think there's even a line that says, you probably paid them off. So, you know, the strongman tropes, they're there, but that's not the showcasing of Messalina. So I call it a toga and sandal film, if we have to get into the whole, you know, the different shades of historic epics out there.
Okay.
Yeah, I would actually agree with that. There was, this was definitely more geared towards what was going on politically. And honestly, it was a little bit difficult to keep track of all the people that were coming through Messalina's bed. it seemed like every few minutes it was a different person that she was either, you know, manipulating sexually or having an affair with. What we thought was interesting is that you definitely knew right away if Messalina liked the guy or just was actually off-putted by him, by the way she would act towards him. And it would be subtle, but it was almost like breaking the fourth wall.
What would happen is, and, you know, since this is still an old school film, there's not a lot of, you know, mouth kissing, you know, in these types of films. So, you know, in a very old school way, the guys would come in like, oh, Messalina, how I adore you and love you. And they go in for smooches, but, you know, they go for the neck. You know, they just bury their heads in her neck. And you see that in a lot of, you know, old Hollywood films and stuff as well. And what we found is, you know, depending on who the person was, if Messalina really didn't like that person, you know, she's just utterly using him and had no attraction, she would make like this scowling face. She would like kind of lean her head back, yeah, to the side and toward the camera. So it's like us as the audience are the only ones that could see this. So it's, I don't think it's fourth wall breaking per se, but it kind of feels like it. Like we as the audience are the only ones who really know, you know, does this person meet Messalina's stamp of approval?
Most did not, by the way. She Lucius seems to get through that wall.
Yeah.
But
others don't.
Others don't. And in fact, I don't think she even actually ever touches Claudius. I don't
No.
think there's ever any sort of touching whatsoever.
No, there's no consummation or anything between those two at all.
Yeah.
Now, I do got a couple more things to say about Peplum, but real quick, since you're on the subject, because Messalina, she makes these faces, we have to kind of point out her makeup in this film. She has the most angular and severe-looking makeup out of, like, any Peplum woman. She looks like she's in a perpetual, I don't want to say scowl, but it's also not the colloquial term resting bitch face. It's not that either, but the way her eyes are always so furrowed, she's always intense looking. It's like a very beautiful intense, but you know, someone who has this gaze that I can see why men fall to her gaze of, this is a powerful and beautiful woman. But just, you know, she has like these cheekbones and stuff that have been heightened with makeup. She's extremely stern and severe looking, but not like, because,
and I don't think any of the other women could possibly compare to her in that film. So
yeah,
they really took a lot of care with her, with how she appeared visually on the screen. They were very smart about how they did that.
The other thing I want to point out, going back to kind of Peplum genre conventions here, this is something I actually wrote about a little bit in Michelle's James Bond book, because in Michelle's James Bond book, I have an entire essay on Eurospy films, which, you know, again, it's a felone, just like the Peplum is. In that essay, I brought in some quotes from Sir Christopher Frayling, and along with the authors of the Italian Eurospy Guide, Matt Blake and someone else, and they talk about bar fights. They basically say along the lines of, in the spy film, you have these nightclub scenes, but in spaghetti westerns, the equivalent of that is the bar fight scenes. And the Eurospy Guide also kind of echoes those sentiments. And you can see a couple bar fights and, you know, some Eurospy fights in some of the 077 films with Richard Harrison. But as we were watching Messalina, towards the beginning, there's a bar fight. The characters, they're celebrating their Armenian campaign, so everyone's super happy. So what do you do when you're super happy? You walk into a bar and you start some fights with people. And it's not like people hate each other or out to kill each other. They're all drunk and
it seems like
it's happy.
It's sort of, I'm not going to say an orgy, but it's another way to express the excess of society. And I would say the joy, the happiness, probably the relief of coming back for more after so long a time.
Yeah, so they're having just an impromptu bar fight, and they're all laughing with each other as well. Even the people getting punched are kind of laughing, and men coming in with women, the men get punched and the women get taken off so they can go party with other folks. And it's kind of an interesting scene. We've seen a couple other, like, tavern fight scenes and other peplum. But it also made me think of, what's the other equivalent of, like, a bar fight scene? And that is the palace scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens at the end of Miscellanea where...
We have three
festival scenes, but at the very end, the last one is when Claudius and his men rush in to kill the renegade, one or two Praetorian guards and the rest of the aristocracy that try to usurp Claudius. And, you know, for all purposes, you know, this is just like a bar. It's a place to, you know, eat, drink, and be killed. And so, you know, I guess the Euro spy film has this nightclub scene. The spaghetti western has its tavern fight. And I guess the peplum has its palace festival scene. I'm just going to call it that. I mean, I don't know the proper term for the courtyard of festivities. I mean, we've seen peplum all the time. You know, usually they are full of belly dancers and other things. But if you have a fight that breaks out there, I guess that's just the same tradition, just different genre.
And I would say, segueing for just a moment, these are points that you actually made in your Westworld essay.
Really?
As part of substantiating the peplum elements within the Westworld movie when they're in the Roman world.
I'm going to confess I wrote that essay 2 years ago and it hasn't been published. Now I'm free to reread it. I hope it's good. All right, so let's talk about Messalina herself. Because Cleopatra aside, she's kind of like the only one. Messalina is one of the rare instances of a female-fronted peplum. Now, you know, decades later, you're going to get a Xena, and then, you know, decades after that, we're going to get like a Cassandra and Assassin's Creed Odyssey. But, you know, usually women in peplum films, you know, they're third-tier characters. They're not even second-tier characters, you know. Secretary usually goes to sidekicks and bad guys. You know, the women are, you know, typically vamps, belly dancers, princesses in distress that pop in the last third of the movie to be rescued and maybe fall in love with. But Messalina, you know, she's the titular character. She is the, if not the main character, at least main character B, because I think the camera still focuses on Lucius a bit more because it's his perspective. Or it may be 50-50, but regardless, this is a top-billed, female-fronted peplum film that's not a Cleopatra film. And I think that's kind of noteworthy, especially since if you think of a classic peplum, you know, what is the big hallmark of a peplum? Is the strong man, you know, the feats of strength, using their muscles for combat, arena games, you know, performing these Herculean efforts. Well, what's the equivalent of that for a female-fronted character in a peplum film if you don't want her to be a belly dancer? And, you know, she's still, Messalina, she, just like a strong man, uses her body, albeit she uses it for seduction. She has all these poses that she does that heightens her sexuality. She, you know, whenever a man that she does like comes to bed, she'll sprawl out on the bed and she just arches her back and puts her arms above her to really make her figure lithe and slender. There's scenes of she'll be taking a milk bath and
so yes,
there's nudity, but there's still nothing to the imagination. There's panning shots where she disrobes and the camera goes down. So you see leg nudity, but again, you know, you could fill in the blanks for this. But she has, and you know, I'm focusing on her body just because, you know, just as Steve Reeves is a very, you know, muscular man, she's a very beautiful lady, and that's, you know, her equivalent of using her body to perform stuff. But she also is shrewd a little bit, but she still has beauty, charm, and guile as well that allows her to be ruthless and cunning through all this.
And definite intellect that, you know, comes with your leading male. While it might be a lot of brawn, there's also, you know, thought behind the actions that are taken. I think there's more emphasis on hers because it's, you know, to the detriment of a lot of other people.
I would say think back to last week when we watched I'll actually bring up Ursus a couple of times in our dialogue today just because it's so fresh, right. But Ursus and the Valley of the Lions, we had the slave girl that was trying to rise up the ranks quickly. Hey, I want to become, you know, not necessarily your queen, but your equal. Here's some information to go find Ursus. And then I'm going to go free Ursus, but I'm going to kill my, you know, rival other slave girl. And, you know, she's trying to be cunning and ruthless as well. But, you know, her efforts are very short-term, and they spectacularly fail. Messalina's eventually will fail as well. You know, you can only be ruthless for so long before something comes up and bites you in the butt. And it does happen to Messalina, but that takes the entire film or, you know, years. While the attempt to be cunning female character in Ursus and Valley Alliance, that doesn't have any thoughts. You know, she's like, okay, I'm going to free Ursus, and I'm going to go stab this other girl. Even though people are right in the next room, they could run in at any moment and catch me in the act. Oh, they did. Oh, what am I ever going to do? So, you know, a display of cunning and guile working, and cunning and guile, you don't know what you're doing, girl.
Well, and on the original poster, substantiating what you're talking about too, Nick, is the fact that in the original poster, if you look at Wikipedia, the image is of Lucius and Messalina on her back, her arm over his neck and in his hair, and she's pulling him towards her. In the background, we have the soldiers, the fighting, but the focus is on her, her beauty, her sexuality, and her charm to pull him in, and the fact that she's the center.
To be fair, that poster delivers exactly what the movie promises. There's a lot of peplum posters that, you know, they have a little bit of liberties, like the Ursus in the Valley of the Lions. It shows actually, like, lions attacking the elephants. I'm like, that didn't quite happen in the film.
Uh-huh.
Or we watch Slaves, and the poster has, like, entire buildings exploding. I'm like, that definitely did happen in the film, but this is a poster where, yeah, that's the movie. It does a good job.
And the other thing about it is that when we're looking at it, her name is at the top. She is top billing. It says Belinda Lee in really big, bold font. Everyone else that is in the film is very small. It's underneath the title and in the image of my printed paper. You can't read the names of anybody else, but you
and
can definitely see.
And
her.
She wasn't a big, big star. I mean, we could probably assume if she hadn't died in a car crash, she was probably going to be on her way to be a huge star. So even though she had credits to herself, I think having that honor of top billing in this is probably a cool thing.
Particularly, you know, the fact that she'd only been, I think, 5 years into, no, 6 years, into her career, and the fact that although she'd worked with Eileen, she'd worked with Hammer, and she had a contract with Rank, she had some things going on in her personal life that actually Rank Organization in 1958 decided that they would not renew her contract with them. She had been having a relationship with a married man. You know, there was questions of whether there had been attempted suicide, and they're like, we don't need this. And, you know, if nothing else, that probably, you know, that sent her off to Europe. You know, she's quoted as saying that she always, you know, she didn't want to play the girl next door. She wanted to be taken seriously. She wanted to have meatier roles. And in June 1959, she says, now all the films that I make, one after another, it won't last, but now I'm in demand. I might as well cash in on it. For the first time, I make money. So that's kind of interesting that probably from before, you know, she wasn't making a whole lot prior to getting more roles in Europe. And she says, always I'm asked now to play wicked women. And, well, let's be honest, she does look kind of wicked. But... anyway, not sure where I was going to go with that, other than the fact that, you know, that did send her off to Europe, and she was building a career for herself. that was cut short.
And I'd say this was probably right at the beginning of when, you know, American B actors were making their way to Italy to rejuvenate their career, you know, the John Saxons and the Cameron Mitchells and whatnot. So, you know, she's kind of at the start of that wave.
Yeah.
But the thing is, she wasn't a fallen actress. You know, she was
no.
on the up and up while the other folks were kind of in stymied careers. So some production stuff that we kind of noticed. So as she was watching Messalina, at the end there, you know, Claudius, he's in his, you know, he's being ferried over a river to go to some other town, and there's an ambush of Praetorian guards, and like, retreat, you know, let's go hold our position by these waterfalls. And as we pan by these waterfalls, Michelle, you know, slaps the table, even though there wasn't a table there. She's like, those look like the waterfalls from that Ursus film we just watched. And so what I did, and I actually posted them to your Facebook group, is, you know, I went and took a screenshot from Ursus and the Valley Lines, because there's a scene in there where Ursus and his girl, you know, they're playing in a lake together. Oh, you can't see me like this. Oh, you know, I'm too modest. Why are you so modest? And you put them side by side, like, those are the same waterfalls. So, of course, you know, off to Google, you know, famous waterfalls in Italy, just going through the images. And, you know, sure enough, they're the waterfalls of Monte Gelato. And apparently they shoot a lot of films there. I guess it's a pretty accessible place and it looks pretty. But so here we go. There's two Peplum films that we know of that are shot at the waterfalls of Monte Gelato. So we'll have to keep an eye out for more of those.
Well, and the reason that, you know, we're watching for similarities is that it was filmed at, or shot at the same studio, the Cinecittà. Is it
yeah.
Cinecittà studio?
So Cinecittà, you know, there's a couple big studios in Italy during this time because, again, Italy is cranking out so many films. You had, like, Tiburnius studio, but Cinecittà was the big, big one. And why that's important to Peplum stuff is that's where they shot Ben-Hur back in 57 when they were doing pre-production. I mean, I thought when they released Ben-Hur, but, you know, after Ben-Hur was done, you know, a lot of those extras and actors, you know, like, hey, what can we do with this next? I know, let's make Hercules and all these other stuff. But that all began at Cincinnati. I can't speak Italian. But, you know, that a lot of Italian genre cinema was shot there. But, you know, Ben-Hur being the first kind of big one. And, you know, again, a lot of American and British productions are coming in and using these facilities, and hence why, you know, they come, they pay up their money, and Italians are like, hey, this stuff is selling, you know, what can we do? Let's crank out our own. And hence Hercules and all these other films. And again, as we talked about in Ursus last week, how tragic, you know, these films have aged in quality.
Oh, yeah, this yes. is a good thing to bring up.
And
yeah.
and Messalina is not. You know, here's this new release of it. It's vibrant. It's widescreen. It's gorgeous. And there's some great shots in it. There's these big shots that show the palaces on top of stairs with all the guards in front of it. It really sinks you in, and it makes it look really big budget. But the film quality is great. And, of course, again, we watched Ursus last week. We've seen so many other Alpha Video releases, and it just tugs my heartstrings. You know, it makes me think of, you know, some of these other films, if there was a good print of it, we would have found it by now and released it by now. Or conversely, there is a good print and it's sent out in Italy and there's like, yeah, there's no market for this stuff. Either way, it's tragic. So, I mean, you know, I kind of ask myself, why does Messalina survive while some of these other, you know, lower budget fares don't? You know, they're made at the same studios. They're made by the same directors. They all have the same cast and crew. They're all financed the same way. And I don't mean to say what one's better than the next. It's just why do some preserve quality-wise to today and others don't? This is kind of, again, I bring it up all the time. This is kind of sad. I hate to see a film, worst, be destroyed, but second worst, just be, you know, just no care in trying to preserve it. You know, making a movie is a big thing, people.
Well, and I think, you know, given the fact that if we look back to The Silence, I think 80% of the silent films are gone forever.
And I would actually wonder how many, you know, what is the percentage of these Italian films? Because so many were made. I mean, they had such a prolific production group going on that I would be very curious. Ursus, you know, it is not good quality. It's in a sepia tone.
Blurred,
but, you know, in Messalina, we can see, you know, those gorgeous waterfalls. I mean, and this is a beautiful movie to look at as well.
Yeah, if this was an alpha video type quality, it'd be, one, unwatchable, because I think the success of this film rests on, you have to have a gorgeous starlet be Messalina, and not just gorgeous, but one that has, you know, the facial expressions, the subtlety in that facial acting, and, you know, have some subpar, you know, cut of that would just destroy it. It would be unwatchable. It'd be
Yeah, and, you know, as Nick was saying, Twilight Time put a Blu-ray out, and it's a limited edition series. And so for people that are not familiar with Twilight Time, they do limited series, and they do go out of print very quickly.
They did a Demetrius and the Gladiators release 5 years ago. It's way out of print, and it goes for over $100. I'm like,
yeah. Yeah, and, you know, this particular release comes with a very nice booklet. It has an essay. I don't know who the essay is from. You know, it's fairly lengthy. It has images from the movie. It looks like some behind-the-scenes shots as well are included in this, which makes it, you know, even more of a document and allows this film to be even more appreciated.
So let's talk about these Christian Democrats. I brought them up earlier because they're going to shake this. So, you know, post-World War, the Christian Democrats basically held political power in Italy, I think all the way up to the early 80s. I'm not so great at Italian history. That's not the 60s, but like in the late 70s, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of oil crises, assassinations and stuff going on. And so I think they lost power during that time. But in the 50s and 60s, you know, they were all about the production machine films because, you know, it's a little bit of propaganda going on there. But, you know, they control a lot of what gets funded, what doesn't get funded. And they ultimately are also the censors of you can display this and you can't display that. Well, here's the deal. You know, during this period, you know, this is a lot of genre fare. And these are movies, and not just the Peplum. I mean, all of them. You know, they have blood. They have a lot of violence, be it sword play or if it's a giallo film, someone getting stabbed with a knife or spaghetti Western people getting shot. You know, this is an era of violence. Some of it cartoony, as we saw in the Ursus film last week, and some of it very, very serious. There's also, you know, there's allusions to sex, you know, a lot of off-screen sex. Any on-screen sex is, you know, depicted through, you know, again, belly dancing or very sheer clothing. It wasn't until, like, Antonio Margheriti's Castle of Blood that you saw some actual nudity. So, you know, how do you get away with these things? Well, you got to, you know, tit for tat, you know. If the characters are going to, you know, have sex out of wedlock and engage in killing of other people, well, they got to atone for it somehow. You've got to, you know, through these narratives, you got to say at the very end, you know, the values that the Christian Democrats need to promote are reinforced. And so what that means is characters, they have to die. Or they have to convert. And I talked about this before. I did my master's thesis on Antonio Margheriti's Castle of Blood. And that was a big thing I really dived into. Here was a film that had nudity, killing, necrophilia, lesbianism. How can you have all this stuff in a horror film? Well, at the very end, you kill the main characters. Because at the end, they get punished for engaging in these activities. And that sends the message to viewer-goers that they can have their titillation, but at the end of the day, also know that, you know, they might have to repent for, or pay pin or whatever for that. Cause and effect, consequences for this stuff. And in Messalina, there is that here. For Messalina, she engages in a lot of promiscuous activities.
she's shown in as close to nudity as possible. And how does she, excuse me, atone for all this or pay for it? Well, she gets stabbed in the gut by Narcissus. And then our hero, Lucio Massimo, you know, he falls for her charms. I mean, he's in love with her, but, you know, you can kind of make the argument, you know, he's in love, or is he bewitched? Is he under her spell? Is it a bit of both? He's definitely blinded by her, because what happens in the middle of the film is there is a village of Christians, because at this point, you know, Christians are a very, you know, subclass in Italy, and they're being kicked out of their homes by Messalina. And Lucio has, you know, two friends, a senator and a soldier, and the senator wants to protect these people while the soldier wants to get rid of them. And so, you know, and they hate each other. They used to all be best friends, but now they hate each other. So, you know, kind of what way is Lucio going to go? Because up to this point, Lucio's been kind of presented as a very honorable person. You know, he's one of those warriors. We would see this decades later in the 80s where you talk about Vietnam. We're like, yeah, you know, those politicians are holding us back, but I'm in there just to fight the war, you know, and go home. I kind of sense that a little bit from Lucio, you know, let the politicians do their thing. I'm a warrior. You know, he now has a decision to make. Is he going to back up the senator and protect these people, or is he going to back up the soldier and let their lands get taken away? Well, what does Messalina want?
Yeah.
Kind of gas. He sides with Messalina, and these Christians are forced out of his homes. And to me, you know, he has to pay the price for that. That's, even later in the film, he kind of gets off a little scot-free. Even one of the characters says, you know, you don't have any blood on your hands. You know, you haven't done anything truly egregious, or whatever the word is, for Messalina, you know, except for this kind of one thing. So how does he atone for all this? Well, this is where Messalina dips its toe a little bit into biblical peplum. It doesn't go like full-on Ben-Hur or full-on Revolt of the Slaves. But, you know, there is a very, very tiny subplot of Christians that, you know, they now just got kicked out of their home by Lucio, and so they're all traveling to another land. And one of those Christians is Sylvia, and Sylvia falls in love with Lucio because reasons.
He's an attractive fellow.
Even though you burned my house down and kicked me out, I love you anyway.
Well, and what they handle this actually
correctly,
in a rather comical way. Sylvia, since she no longer has a home and Lucius is the catalyst having a home, she goes to his home and says, well, you burned me out. I don't have anywhere to go, so I'm coming here. And she basically takes up in his home, and she calls him master. And at one point, what's interesting, she says that, you know, men are either masters or husbands.
Uh-huh. So how does Lucio atone for, you know, kicking these Christians out of their lands? Well, it's implied that he becomes a Christian, but at the very least, at the very end, he runs to the procession of Christians as they're obsequiously going to board their boat and sail off to their new land. But he joins up with Sylvia and joins that procession. So I can only assume that the next step would be him probably converting. And he has, you know, I guess it's not a bad gig. You know, he doesn't get Messalina. He gets Sylvia, who is, you know, they portray her as very light and very childlike, but also very...
She's pretty. She's like 17. She's on the cusp of being a woman. She is also not hesitant to vocalize how she feels about things. The other thing is that you see Lucius at the end, he's riding his, you know, legion horse that only has a blanket on it. He's not even dressed in a uniform anymore. It's like he has shed all of his worldly possessions and takes up with Sylvia to walk off into the sunset and the end.
So you know, if you had to put it out there, how does this movie that has some off-screen sex, lots of titillation, some battles at the end, there's bloodshed, there's people being stabbed. You know, how do you get all this? How do you get your cake and eat it too? Well, the bad people definitely have to die. I mean, they do. That, you know, final scene of the Claudius coming in and killing all the aristocrats and Messalina herself, are you convert to Christianity. You know, you join them at the end, and you know, those are the two ways out in this type of film. And so I would say that's kind of the, you know, unseeing hand of the, you know, political, real-life political machinations that have guided this film. Apparently, the 1950s Messalina is even more overt in its Christian themes. I think there's apparently an arena battle at the end where Christians are fed to lions or something. So this movie definitely toned it down. So in that way, I guess it's a little bit more on the subversive side.
I wonder if that actually made it more accessible. It actually is, on the original poster, it actually is Warner Brothers, so I guess they are the ones that distributed in the U.S. at the time. It was also, they cut 12 minutes from the running time. So the running time is 96 minutes, but when they put it out originally in the U.S., they cut it to 84 minutes.
That's 12 minutes of Caligula-style orgies. Wait, what was that, Hercules? I was just making a bad joke. What was that?
Do you know what was on those 12 minutes and why they cut them?
No, I don't.
No, and I'm just looking now to see if there's like any sort of note. There is a note. It looks like it's in, you'd have to go to the Italian Sword and Sandal films from 1908 to 1990. Hey, it's McFarlane.
I have that book.
Oh, well, it's in there. It tells you about the 12 minutes.
Maybe I should have consulted that book before coming on this podcast. It's right there in the other room. I consulted it for Ursus. I guess I was too bewitched by Messalina to, you know, not further. So anyway, I guess one of the last questions I would have for Messalina is, as she has been stabbed in that very dramatic fashion, you know, Lucius is holding her, and she's like, keep in mind, Lucius is totally smitten with her. You know, that's his kind of character arc, is trying to balance how much he loves her to realizing that, you know, she's not a very good person. But, you know, Messalina confesses, you know, I've only loved you. You know, all these other people, you know, that I've loved, and I'm doing that in air quotes, you know, it was definitely for political gain and favors. But you, you're the exception. I loved really only you. Now imagine that said not as snarky and more melodramatic by Messalina. So that kind of raises the question, is did she really love Lucius? Or was, at the very end, was Lucius still a pawn in her games? We know that Lucius loved her unconditionally, but did she love him back unconditionally? That despite juggling all these other suitors, that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, she could be in any one person's arms that would have been his. What do you think, Michelle?
Well, I think we differ of opinion, but I do feel that kind of based on the visual cues that we have throughout the movie of whether, her aside glances and her disgust portrayed through her expressions, I would also go back to what she originally says to the Vesta priestess, is that she was looking for life, power, but also love. And to me, my feeling is that, you know, because of the duality, she did really want to control and be the most powerful woman. I think she really wanted it with Lucius. So I do actually believe that in as much as she understood what love was, it probably was a love for her. Maybe not on the same par as Lucius, because we don't really have much of a background of, you know, who he is or, you know, his involvement with other women. But I do think as best that she could, I think that she did love him in her way.
In her own way?
But I think she fully believed that she loved him.
Now Lucius is one of the only characters that, you know, when he's in her embrace, isn't getting the scowling treatment. And so that's kind of what I have to go by, is, you know, he is treated slightly different than the others. But, you know, a lot of these films, not just Peplum, but, you know, the lovey-dovey love stories out there, you know, they all kind of have the same thing of, for true love, you would sacrifice it all for true love. And Messalina is not capable of doing that. And that's, if we're going to go by that trope of, oh, I will give up everything to be with you, as cliche as that is, but, you know, people love that stuff in their literature and their films and whatnot. You see it on Lifetime movies all the time. But, you know, if the idea of love is sacrifice, I don't think Messalina was capable of loving because she's not capable of making sacrifice.
Well, and I would pose with regards to the true love, that do we have that in these stories to begin with?
Yeah.
What's an example?
Ursus. We can watch it, you know, but that lady, you know, didn't have to go off of Ursus. You know, she could have stayed a slave and been to the palace and probably treated pretty well. But she came, I mean, I'm just kind of, maybe I'm reaching for straws here just because, you know, examples aren't coming to my brain all of a sudden. But, you know, I'm thinking of that, you know, she wants to live in a cave with Ursus instead of in a palace where at least she's probably as a courtesan or something, you know. Again, you know, I know there's other movies out there where it's like, I will totally wait for you as you come back from battle and all that type of stuff.
I just think it's probably rare.
You think it's rare?
Yeah. I don't know. What do you think, Hercules?
You've seen way more peplum films than we have. So how often does that occur where a person, man or woman, will throw it all away to be with their beau?
I can't draw any specific examples, or none of them come to mind in this moment. However, it does seem to happen, from here to there. Like, for instance, Hercules in Steve Reeves' movie, when he found Iole, he gave up his whole godhood so that he could be with her. And she had to overcome all the objections that she had to him because of his role in the death of her brother. But they seem to have, you know, overcome that by the end of the movie. And there are numerous other examples when either the male or the female, protagonist will kind of change what they were doing, their course of action, their modus operandi, so that they could be with another person. But again, nothing is coming to mind in the moment.
We saw that in Revolt of the Slaves where, you know, the guy was going to give up all his possessions and stuff and convert to Christianity so he could be a Rhonda Fleming.
Okay, so it does exist out there. Look, it just seems like, you know, we don't see it often.
Keep in mind, you know, the primary focus of a lot of these films is the muscular men with this big muscles that I'm going to take down 50 men at once. I don't got time for love. I've only got time for hitting things.
Well, and I guess, you know, also, Messalina is from a different perspective. It is from the woman's perspective.
Correct.
Which, you know, right away makes it a more unique perspective than what we're used to.
So, yeah, so back at the end, does she love him? Gray area for my answer, just because, one, she does treat him slightly differently, but two, I just, again, going by that sacrifice for love, she is a no-compromise person. Let's be honest, take no prisoners.
Well, that is true.
So recommended for different reasons. While Ursus in the Valley of the Lions last week was more of a cartoony strongman fun, this one is definitely intrigue and not suspense, but definitely political intrigue and watching, you know, wrestling of powers between folks. You know, not through, you know, arm wrestling or feats of strength, but through wit and guile and maybe even a little bit of love.
And Messalina appears in a lot of films, some of them actually adult films that were filmed during the time.
I know she was in the Tinto Brass Caligula, and I have seen that. I may own a couple copies of that, but I just don't remember it. I mean, when you're watching a film with Malcolm McDowell that's ordering giant machines to saw off people's heads, a lot of stuff, you know, gets relegated to, I don't remember that.
Well, and it's interesting that you bring that up, Hercules, because there's reasons for that. She is kind of remembered through various literature of, you know, contemporary or near contemporary, and then probably about, you know, 100 years later, there's more writing of her that is then perpetuated through the ages to modern times. It's always, you know, the overriding perception of her is her political drive and, of course, her promiscuous behaviors. And
history is definitely written by the winners.
Yeah, you know, so in case people are curious, Tacitus and Suetonius wrote about 70 years after the event. They were actually living in an environment that was hostile to the imperial line in which Messalinus belonged. So right there, you're going to have a different historical documentation. Cassius Dio was writing about 150 years after, and he had the bias of being suspicious of women. So, you know, there's all this, you know, a kind of perception of her promiscuous behavior that overrides anything else. The other thing is that, you know, how do we perpetuate a lot of these stories? Well, through our culture. And so, you know, through art, through film, through our literature, through the theatrical stories that are told. You know, she, along with Cleopatra, who we've also talked about in previous episodes, you know, her fate is such that, you know, her promiscuous behavior, her cunning, her sexual prowess, she, you know, stories abound that she worked in a brothel at night, that she had competitions to, you know, who, you know, could last longer in sex activities in a 24-hour period, debauchery and things like that. And that has been perpetuated over the centuries. I would say go read the Wikipedia and then go from there to read, you know, source material about her. It is actually very fascinating. But bringing it back around to what Nick was saying is that, you know, she, not unlike Cleopatra, you know, has had history written that tends to focus on the negative of their leadership. We don't really know how these people were, and we don't have their writing. So we have to take it all with a grain of salt. But this movie definitely perpetuates a lot of the stories and perceptions of her that are not in the most favorable light, obviously.
We were just informed that we have 90 seconds, and I'd like you guys to share your contact info. I do want to thank you for expanding and adding to my appreciation of this movie. I intend to watch the rest of it between now and tomorrow.
Oh, very good. That's so good. People can find me at my website, michellebrittany.com. I would also say go to Amazon. I have an author page where you can find my writing. My other activity is with HP Lovecast Podcast. We have a public Facebook page there, so you can see what we're doing on that site.
And I'm at nickdiak.com, N-I-C-K-D-I-A-K.com. From there is all my links to all my social medias and all that stuff. I do a weekly roundup of Peplum news and personal news as well.
And I thank you for sharing portals to what both of you are doing in our Sword and Sandal Cinema Group. That's very much appreciated.
You're very welcome. And as always, Hercules, we really appreciate the opportunity to share these older movies and just, you know, appreciating the ancient civilization of Rome, Egypt, and, of course, Greece.
So we will keep them. Thank you so very much. And thanks to everybody who tuned in. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Thanks again, Nick and Michelle.
You're welcome. Cheers.
Cheers.